G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 220th. Goodbye, Dudley. Hello, Devereaux. My name's Dick Newman. Let's get on with it. Just a little sample there of Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2. Not a hit when it came out. Not a hit at all. But the kids kind of like it after a while. So, good on you, Rachmaninoff. Last week we had the less than magnificent defeat of the Armada. Phil really cocked it up. Built big slow-moving ships that were further slowed down by the supply ships. Sent them off into the vagaries of the weather. The smaller English ships could form up in a hurry to harass them. His plan for the Armada to go to Dunkirk was pretty bloody stupid, and in the end it was the wind that gave the English their victory. For Billy, though, of course, it is a marvellous outcome. We also got through to the end of our dallying into Frenchy politics with the death of Catherine. That gave us yet another example where assassinations are a bad idea. King Henri assassinated Henry of Guise, resulting in his own assassination. And a date with an assassin will be coming up for Henry of Navarre, our next King Henry. Where to next, you ask, and so do I. Celebrations in European Protestant nations, of course. Spanish Phil actually took the news rather well. No temper tantrums, and while I may not see this as a mighty English victory portrayed over the years, it certainly was a huge defeat for Phil. Not one Spaniard set foot on English soil. Not one of Alexander Farnese's crack troops even got on a ship. The neutral Scotties didn't allow any help to the banged up Armada, and only about half his ships managed to get back. In London, it was bonfires and Thanksgivings, and London put on a show while Betty rides through on her way to St. Paul's. When I say rides, like Boudicca, Betty had a chariot made, more like a throne on wheels, drawn by two white horses. Guys are getting our very first medals ever struck, and they would rather have had a bit of cash, thanks. Betty is still not known for handing out the cash. The Spanish invasion also got us into a new invention. It's the newspaper. We've had manuscripts, which were like government information to be circulated, and pamphlets, which are like opinion pieces, but these two will now be combined. April 1588, and it's the English Mercury, edition number 1. And don't believe a bit of it, my dear listener. It's fake news. That is, the whole thing is fake news. 1744, and Philip York, 2nd Earl of Hardwick, and Dr. Thomas Birch created this thing as a literary game. They found some old 16th century typeface and created a hoax. They then took a copy of their created old newspaper to the British Museum and said, "Hey, look what we found." Amazing! And we believed it for nearly 100 years. Stuff from it was included in history books at the time. Now, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, was doing some nice strutting around London too, acting like he had been the one true saviour of England. Betty will treat him that way too. He's going to be allowed to have dinner with her every night. Special treat for a special boy. But he'll become unwell and wants to go to the magical waters at Buxton. He'll get as far as Oxford and die. He'd written Betty a letter just before he died, which stayed on her bedside table for the rest of her life. Some will suggest that, like Dudley, his Mrs. Lettice Knollys was a poisoner and did him in. Very unlikely, and we suspect malaria and or stomach cancer. Now, Dudley's reputation is all over the place. Soon after his death, English Catholics in France will publish a book, Leicester's Commonwealth. It's more about Mary Queen of Scots, but there's plenty in there about what an arsehole Dudley was. This thing will be a smash hit in England, but only at underground booksellers. Dudley was a supporter of the Puritans, who Betty hated, and that sometimes gave his rival Christopher Hatton an advantage. Charges of religious hypocrisy, for me, don't stick. He did donate some money to build a hospital, with hospitals at this time more about housing for the poor. So well done on that, Dudley. He could be generous with his friends and servants, while typical noble, always wanting more for himself. He supported scholars, poets, and the theatre. Any murders he's accused of, and there's a few of them, had no evidence to really support them. It's suspicions only, and there were plenty of people at the time being jealous of the Queen's favourite to spread those suspicions. Dudley was crap at the military stuff, but he was a senior man in the Privy Council. His disagreeing with other guys on the council saw two factions which produced opposing advice to Betty. That's good stuff there. Someone like King Donald just wants everyone to agree with him, but if we can have two opposing factions in government, then Betty gets two different sets of ideas to choose from. As a young guy, Dudley was into the good life, with Betty frequently handing him stuff to pay for his fun. She had a rage when he married behind her back, and that's pretty natural. Betty may, though, have been pleased that he'd married, taking the pressure off people wondering whether she would marry him. Now, marrying Dudley would have probably been a total disaster for England. Once he was married, the giving him stuff dropped right off. On his last trip to the Lowlands, Betty had loaned him the money, taking out a mortgage on his barony of Denby. Lettice Knollys will now find the government in taking stuff from his estate to pay off his debts. Lettice will also find that gossip ramping up that not only did she poison Robert Dudley, but she also poisoned her first husband, Walter Devereux. It's just gossip, my dear listener. We'll have a post-mortem on Dudley, but one that is looking for his death by black magic. Yeah, good luck with that. Still, Dudley's death will mark a turning point for our Betty. With all those nice recent deaths, we've been giving our list of characters a good clear out. I think it could be a good time to bring in a new boy. Let's dig up the corpse of Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, son of Walter Devereux and Lettice Knollys, and therefore stepson of Robert Dudley. Born 10th of November 1565, making him 23 right now. Robert has two older sisters and will have a younger brother. Robert Devereux's dad, Walter, got made an earl thanks for his work in the Northern Rebellion. That will cause a bit of jealousy from Dudley. Betty then sent Walter off to Ireland for a gig, with the gossip having it that Dudley then started banging Lettice. He may or may not have been into the rumpy-pumpy, but he certainly was flirting with Lettice, sending Betty into a rage. Dudley says it's tit-for-tat because he'd seen Betty hanging out at the mall with Thomas Heneage. It's an argument that will see Dudley go to his room and sulk for 4 days, then back to Betty so they can both have a good boo-hoo-hoo. And it's the start of a pattern of behaviour. A year later, and the gossip is out again that Dudley and Lettice are doing the horizontal tango. Walter Devereux comes back from Ireland with the gossip having extended out to Dudley now being the dad of two kiddies with Lettice that were allegedly farmed out somewhere. Some of that stuff, though, comes to us from the very anti-Dudley book, Leicester's Commonwealth. No evidence that Lettice had any kiddies with Dudley at this time. Dudley, of course, was also banging Lady Douglas Sheffield at the same time, and she certainly did have a kiddie. Dudley will be paying for this kiddie's education and upbringing. Walter Devereux will be made Earl Marshal of England. Back off to Ireland for a dodgy dinner and death for Walter. He will manage to write to Betty, "Mine eldest son, upon whom the continuation of my house remaineth, shall lead a life far unworthy his calling, and most obscurely, if it be not helpen by your majesty's bounty and favour, for the smallness of his living, the greatness of my debt, and the dowries that go out of my land, make the remainder little or nothing towards the reputation of an earl's estate." What he's writing about is that he's deep in debt, so 10-year-old Robert, the new Earl of Essex, is actually the poorest earl in England. At least he got the family home, Chartley Manor. His education will, of course, continue. Robert will be off to London under the care of Cecil. His sisters and one brother will go to the Earl of Huntingdon. Robert Devereux can now meet Cecil's son, Robert Cecil. May have been hate at first sight, no idea. These two guys will not be friends. In any case, Robert won't be there long. He's off to Trinity College, Cambridge, run by our current Archie John Whitgift. A kiddie like Robert will have a tutor who looks after more than just his education. Robert needs that, or really, what he needs is money, and that's the tutor's job. September, and no fucking about with the mourning period, Lettice and Dudley will marry. They had actually married secretly some time earlier, but her dad insisted on a public marriage with witnesses. He knows what Dudley's like. Even so, this public marriage will still be done in secret, so Betty won't know. Well, Tease may have been up the spout, but if so, no baby will turn up. Betty, though, will find out about the marriage, hit the roof, and intended to have Leicester committed to the Tower of London, which his enemies much desired. But the Earl of Sussex, though his greatest and deadliest adversary, dissuaded her, for he was of the opinion that no man was to be troubled with lawful marriage, which a state among all men hath ever been held in honour and esteem. Dudley is sent home for a bit, and Lettice is sent home for fucking good. Robert is still out of it, studying at Cambridge. He will meet Welsh type Gelly Maverick, who will be with him for his whole life. Robert will also be visited by Richard Rich, grandson of fucker Richard Rich. Richard wants to marry Robert's sister Penelope. Richard takes after his granddad. Yeah, he's a fucker. He will remove Robert from uni. Even so, Robert will manage to graduate with his arts degree at 15. Free of uni, Robert will hang out in London with Lettice and Dudley, and hey, look, a brand new stepbrother baby, Robert Dudley. Penelope will marry Richie Rich. Walter Devereux had wanted her to marry Philip Sidney, who will instead marry Walsingham's daughter Frances. Philip Sidney won't write a lovely piece about his new wife Frances, but will write a lovely piece about Penelope. Astrophel and Stella. Astrophel, Greek, means star lover, and Stella, Latin, means star. So you've got Astrophel, the star lover, and Stella is his star. And Astrophel is Philip, and Stella is Penelope. Penelope, who hates Richard Rich because he's like his granddad. Not a happy marriage, but at least Penelope is welcome at court, even if her mum is not. Robert attended the marriage in his new fancy duds, costing £40. He's overspending and it's becoming an issue. 1582, and Robert will be off to join his younger brother living with the Earl of Huntingdon. He will write to Cecil. I hope your lordship in courtesy will pardon my youth. If I have, through want of experience, in some sort passed the bounds of frugality. I cannot but embrace with duty your lordship's good counsel, whose love I have effectively proved, and of whose care of my well-doings I am thoroughly well persuaded. I do beseech your good lordship, notwithstanding the lapse of my youth, still to continue a loving friend unto me, as I will acknowledge myself in all duty bound unto your lordship. Lovely letter, but the bottom line is he actually wants more cash, so not so lovely. Robert's other sister, Dorothy, will also be in trouble. She'd fallen in love with the son of that hard man, Sir John Perrott, Lord Deputy of Ireland. Extreme hard man, I should say. Another secret marriage. Perrott's personal chaplain had a church door forced open so that he could do the magic ceremony while guards protected the entrance. Not very romantic, really. Dorothy was one of Betty's maids of honour, so has done the marriage without permission thingy. 1583, and Robert will go on progress with Dudley. Cut short because baby Robert Dudley died. Robert will be off to Lanfy, the Devereux estate in Wales, where it seems he may be just chilling out. Lettice may not have been happy. We don't have her letter to him, but we do have his reply to her. He's sorry if he upset her and he doesn't want to be a bad boy. I'm just looking after myself and, hey, I'm a young guy. I'm doing what young guys do. 1585, and word is out that Mary, Queen of Scots, is to be moved to Robert Devereux's house. He will write to his granddad, Sir Francis Knolly, saying, oh, this is terrible. His house is so small, he'd have to move out and put one of his tenants out of their house so he's got somewhere to live. The foregoing of the use of my house, the spoil of my wood, the marring of my little furniture, the miserable undoing of my poor tenants. Yeah, he doesn't want Mary. Forget it, Robert. Betty's made up her mind, and Mary will go to Chartley for a while. September 1585, and Robert will make his first appearance at court. He doesn't seem to have made much of an impression, and besides, it's all talk about war in the Lowlands. Dudley will get the geek to go over there, and Robert will get permission to go with him. He will, as his habit is by now, spend up bigly on his soldier stuff. Granddad Knollys will write, if I should not love you, I should be unnatural. Again, if I should flatter youthful humours in you, I should be guilty of the ruinous race of your undoing. Wherefore you must give me leave to say unto you that wasteful prodigality hath devoured and will consume all noble men that be willful in expenses before they have of their own ordinary living to bear out such willful and wasteful expenses. It goes on to point out to Robert that his dad didn't even leave him enough money to be the poorest earl in England, and now he's mortgaged lots of stuff to spend on himself and some thugs to go to a stupid foreign war. So, look, you better do well for Dudley in this, but you didn't need to spend all that cash to impress him. He likes you, but like everyone else, he thinks you just waste money that you don't have. Let's have Robert Devereux then going off to look for fame and glory. Bad idea, really, going up against Alexander Farnese. Dudley will make Devereux Colonel General of the Horse. No experience of anything, so Dudley will have Sir William Russell in there to do the actual work, while Devereux can look good. Off they go through Amsterdam onto Utrecht, where they can have a St. George's Day feast and jousting. And young Devereux will do well in the joust. We all have high hopes for this lad. Duke of Parma has taken grave with duchy surrendering. Court case with Devereux at the trial, which sees the commander Baron Hemmert and two captains executed by Dudley. Morale of their troops was already low, and also low were the munitions, and even lower was their pay. They hadn't got it. Troops will start to desert. Worse, of course. The English are divided with Team Dudley, and others being on Team Sir John Norris, Colonel General of the Foot Soldiers. Worse, dinner party with our allies, the Dutchies will see a violent incident. Devereux will write to Dudley. I haste to write to you, though I have no other advertisements but of our own private wars, which I must needs think them more dangerous than the annoyance of any enemy. Yeah, not going well at all. Off goes Devereux to take Doesburg, but he and his captains had trouble stopping their troops doing the rape and plunder stuff. Off they go again, about 500 troops under Devereux to find the enemy and disrupt their supply line. Wandering through the fog, and then, oh look, there's the enemy right in front of us. 3,000 foot and 1,500 horse against our 500. Nothing for it but to charge. This then is where Philip Sidney will cop it. Sidney was Dudley's nephew and his heir. He will write to Walsingham. The grief I have taken for the loss of my dear son and yours would not suffer me to write sooner of those ill news unto you, especially being in so good hope, so very little time before of his good recovery. But he is with the Lord, and his will must be done. If he had lived, I doubt not, he would have been a comfort to us both, and an ornament to his house. What perfection he was grown unto, and how able to serve Her Majesty, and his country, all men here almost wondered at. For my own part, I have lost, besides the comfort of my life, a most principal stay and help in my service here, and if I may say it, I think none of all has greater loss than the Queen's Majesty herself. Freddie Chopin's funeral march there for Philip Sidney. Robert Devereux will score Sidney's sword and be made a knight banneret by Dudley. Winter, so the Duke of Parma will go into winter quarters while Devereux takes Sidney's body back to England. Sidney was a young up-and-comer at court, and Devereux will see himself now slipping into that place. Betty's annual Silly Behatting Day ceremony will see Devereux give Betty a rainbow of diamonds, sapphires and opals, on twin pillars, with one broken to represent our fallen hero and the other one to represent himself. Dudley comes home and the pair are off to see Betty. He may be the one to tip Betty over the edge into the decision to kill Mary, Queen of Scots. Betty signs the death warrant, then sends the message to stop the execution, but too late. This could certainly be one of those plausible deniability exercises. Devereux will now put himself into the story. You may recall that apart from telling the Privy Council to all piss off for a while, Then he put his secretary in the slammer. Devereux will write to King Jim VI. Mr. Davison, fallen into Her Majesty's displeasure and disgrace, beloved of the best and most religious in this land, to stand barred from any preferment or restoring in this place, except out of their honour and nobleness to your royal heart, your Majesty will undertake his cause. He's getting a bit above himself there. Jim VI will not be interfering, nor will he reply to Devereux. He'd done a treaty deal with England, and part of that is he's getting £4,000. Who cares about a secretary? Not Jim. Devereux then will become closer to Betty with two other new boys, Walter Raleigh and Charles Blount. Full disclosure for watchers of Betty movies or readers of Betty books, there are two Blounts arriving in the story. Charles and Christopher, distant cousins. Our new boy Christopher Blount is related to Dudley and is his gentleman of the horse. He'd been over to the lowlands with Dudley and Devereux, and he's worked as a spy for Walsingham. He'll be marrying Lettice Knollys a few months after Dudley's death, so he will be Devereux's stepdad. He's about 10 years older than Devereux. Betty's original toy boys, Dudley and Hatton, were getting quite old by now, so it was these three young guys who were looking to be the Queen's favourite. Devereux will rise to the top of the pack. When she is abroad, nobody near her but my Lord of Essex, and at night my Lord is at cards, or one game or another with her, that he comes not to his own lodging till birds sing in the morning. Dudley's cool with this, getting Betty to give Devereux the master of the horse gig, which pays a handy £1,500 a year. It won't be long until Devereux has a falling out with Betty. Betty went on progress and stopped in at Northall, the home of Robert Rich, Earl of Warwick. Devereux and Dudley were with her. Devereux didn't know this, but his sister Dorothy was staying at the time, so Dorothy had the super-duper guest bedroom. Obviously, if Betty turns up, then Dorothy has to get out of the super-duper guest bedroom and into the cheaper guest bedroom. Betty will say, no, don't move Dorothy out. If I'm kind to Dorothy, the world will be jealous because they'll think it's because of my love for Robert Devereux. Now, this may seem a bit confusing to you and all my dear listener until you think like a queen. If Dorothy gave up the super-duper bedroom to Betty and Betty said yes, then that's Betty doing a kindness to Dorothy. She's being nice to Dorothy. Allowing Dorothy to do something nice for Betty, it's Betty being kind to Dorothy. Weird, I know, but Betty's a queen. Robert Devereux is totally insulted by this and says she only did that to please Walter Raleigh. Robert now is sure Betty will make his life miserable and put him in disgrace. Robert then has had a tiff with Betty and complains she won't hear a bad word against Raleigh. This speech did trouble me so much that, as near as I could, I did describe unto her what he had been and what he was, and then I let her know whether I had cause to disdain his competition of love, or whether I would have comfort to give myself over to the service of a mistress that was in awe of such a man. He'll keep on bagging Raleigh, even though Robert thinks Raleigh is listening at the door. Robert's not doing well, so Betty will now hop into him about his mum, Lettice Knollys. Robert will say, fine, even though it's nearly midnight, I will toss Dorothy out of bed, so you can't say no to taking the super-duper bedroom. As for me, I don't want to be near a person who loves a dickhead like Walter Raleigh. Betty will just turn away and start talking to someone else. Robert will send his guys to get Dorothy, and they'll all be off. Sulky boy. He will keep on going, looking to get a ship to Sluice, where Dudley is trying his hand at the soldiering again. Betty will send a guy to say, all forgiven, before he sets sail. This day will now be a pattern for Robert. He'll be overly jealous of anyone else in court who gets something from Betty. He'll become very proficient at sulking. Walter Raleigh, though, can see that Betty fancies Devereux. He'll just write a poem about it. Fortune has taken you away, my love, my life's joy and my soul's heaven above. Fortune has taken you away, my princess, my world's delight and my true fancy's mistress. There's also rumours that Raleigh has been backstabbing Dudley. Dudley will come back from Sluice and Raleigh will leave the court. 1588 and 22-year-old Walter Devereux will get to live at York House in London. He'll become a Knight of the Garter and be hanging out with Betty. Great for him, Not great for England, with the threat of invasion. Dudley gets command of the ground troops and will appoint Devereux General of the Horse. He'll spend £3,500 on his company of 320 troops who will all wear very fancy duds. All done and dusted, so waste of money for Robert. Dudley can die, sending Betty his last letter. I most humbly beseech your majesty to pardon your poor old servant to be thus bold in sending to know how my gracious lady does, and what ease of a late pain she finds, being chiefest thing in this world I do pray for her to have good health and long life. For my own poor case, I continue still your medicine and find that it mends me much better than with any other thing that has been given me. Thus hoping to find a perfect cure at the bath, with the continuance of my wonted prayer for your majesty's most happy preservation, I humbly kiss your foot. Now Dudley died in debt, allowing Betty to get revenge on his widow, Lettice Knollys. Dudley's house in London, Leicester House, was left to his other bastard, Kitty. Robert Devereux will rent it eventually, changing its name to Essex House. This will now become the family bolt hole if things get tough. His sister Penelope will move in pretty darn fast. She's over that fucker, Richie Rich. Dudley had been Chancellor of Oxford, nice earner, so Robert wants it. Betty will give it to Sir Christopher Hatton. Devereux is looking for more military action. He wants to be a mighty hero. He's still hanging out at court, and in comes our other Blount, Charles Blount. This one is just 2 years older than Devereux. He's a second son, whose older brother died, giving him the title Baron Mountjoy. Right now, he's caught Betty's eye on the tournament thingy, and she's given him a little gold thing to pin on his chest. And isn't Robert Devereux super-duper jealous? He will say, "Now I perceive every fool must wear a favour." "That there's dueling words," says Blount. Off they go, and Blount will manage to stick a bit of his sword in Devereux's thigh. Betty will hear about it, and both boys will be tossed out of court to cool down. Betty will say, "By God's death, it was fit that someone or other should take him down and teach him better manners. Otherwise, there would be no rule with him." And Robert Devereux is proving to be a bad boy to love. Betty's worked out what Devereux is like, but still, nice to have a couple of lads fighting over you. Unlike his relationship with Raleigh, Devereux and this Blount will become BFFs. Well, eventually he'll become good mates with Raleigh too. We'll get there. This Blount, Charles, will end up banging Devereux's sister Penelope, who has given Richie Rich the flick, while the other Blount, Christopher, will be banging Devereux's mum, Lettice, when he marries her. All good fun, I'm sure. Devereux is deep in debt, which does not stop him from giving Betty gifts. Nice expensive gifts. That will get him a monopoly to charge tax on sweet wines renewable every 5 years. It had been Dudley's, and it's a nice earner. But of course he wants more, more, more. Okay, let's check in on Sir Francis Drake by having a look at Dom Antonio, who is still pining for the Portuguese silly hat. It's a good time for Dom Antonio right now, with the Armada being stuffed up. We may see this bloke as a bit of a dreamer. Philip booted him out of Portugal, and he hadn't been able to hold it while he was in the country, so what's his chance of taking it with Phil solidly in there? Phil is actually a pretty decent ruler domestically, so the Portuguese don't mind him. With Phil, they know what they can expect, but Dom Antonio is an unknown quantity. Can't see the Portuguese being keen in supporting him in a local war. Phil's also been systematically identifying and neutralising Dom Antonio's support team. In England, like anywhere else, though, we have hard men pushing for wars and merchants looking at getting after our mighty victory to make money. Common Smellies' role remains to go and kill and die for their magnificent betters. Francis Drake is absolutely at the top of his game. His place in history is assured. So you and I might say, hey, Francis, buy the blue anchor in Helston and in Cornwall there and sell Bingo to make the locals happy. Enjoy a nice semi-retirement, mate. And he may have been thinking that way, but another mighty adventure first could also be tempting. Across the Mediterranean from Spain is the Moor Mully Hamid, who will contact Dom Antonio saying, hey, buddy, an English navy can use my ports and buy provisions here if you like. I can also lend you cash and hard men, and you can pay me back when you're the King of Portugal. Betty, Cecil, Walsingham and Drake were all thinking about how we may follow up the Armada thing with a right cross to Spanish Phil's jaw. Two plans are under consideration. First, slip off to find where that Armada is and finish them off. Or, second, go to the Azores and catch more treasure ships and deprive Phil of cash. But we've also got to consider the offer from the Moorish Mully Hamid of Fez to support Dom Antonio. Problem that is we're already fighting in the lowlands and still out to support Huguenots in France. An attack on Spain would open up a third front, and that's getting a bit much. Their goals are to prevent another invasion attempt in England and get Phil to come to terms with the Dutch. Drake will be pushing to help Dom Antonio. And you might too if you heard Dom Antonio talking about all the support he'll be getting. Or maybe you wouldn't, my dear listener, because by now I'm sure you are fully aware that these guys are full of shit. Okay, we'll get down to a definition of the mission. 1. Destroy the remainder of the Armada somewhere around Lisbon. 2. Take Lisbon and get the locals to rise up in support of Dom Antonio. And 3, head back via the Azores to get cash to pay for it all and take the Azores in the name of Dom Antonio. The Azores, if I haven't mentioned it, are off the coast of Portugal, about a third of the way to America. It's a nice place to stop in on your way to or from America. Phil knows that the Azores would be total heaven for English privateers, so he's already reinforcing the place. Same old problem though. Where's the money going to come from for the English venture? Drake will partner with hard man Sir John Norris, who had worked under Walter Devereux in Ireland, and then did mighty hero stuff against the Duke of Parma, so has become our top operator in the mighty hero league ladder. Sir John's granddad had been executed for allegedly banging Anne Boleyn, and his mum and dad are Biddy's good mates. He's well connected with military types. Best of all, he's keen as mustard. Francis and John will be off looking for investors. Betty's broke, but she will still be an investor. They will bring in a lot of loot, and their adventure is starting to look like a counter-armada. Drake can get to work on the shipping side while John's off getting hardbin. Yeah, the guys he gets aren't first rate, so he's going to go over to the lowlands to see if he can get some real soldiers. The Dutchies will come through with not only hard men, but horse and ships too. It's back to going well. But John will withdraw too many English troops. Betty will say, just replace them yourselves, and by the way, I'm giving up Ostend because I can't defend it anymore. Fuck all that, say the Dutchies, and those ships and a fair whack of their experienced soldiers won't turn up. John's also having logistics problems getting guys across to England. It's all going slowly, and Betty, as usual, is prevaricating signing the commission for the action. Investors are pulling out. We've now got guys just sitting around doing nothing, but still they get paid. Expenditure is getting out of hand. Betty's also stressing the point that their top priority is to destroy the remains of the Armada, and she's thinking Dom Antonio is talking shit. Objective 2, which is take Lisbon, is now take care. Only attack if you're sure the locals will rise for Dom Antonio. If that looks a bit too hard, just give it a miss and concentrate on hitting the Spanish shipping. But make sure you hit the Azores on the way home to bring back the bacon. That's not a bad plan, so, of course, Francis and John don't want it. They want to be mighty heroes taking Lisbon. Betty May be onto it. A council will be appointed to advise them, and a special representative will be on board to keep a record of what they do and remind them of what they're supposed to be doing. Dom Antonio is talking up about how beloved he is in Portugal. He isn't. He's foot broke, so Drake will lend him some cash for armour, and Robert Devereux will buy him a coach, and Betty will outfit his bodyguard. All good, says Dom Antonio, 10 days into Lisbon, and I should have the keys to the piggy bank. He's actually thinking that he'll borrow the money from the Moors. March 1589, and we're off, with Drake sailing right on into about 70 little Dutch flyboats. Just what he needs to transport troops off the ship, so he'll be having them, thanks. Wind's blowing the wrong way, so troops can hop off again for training, but they're eating up the food supplies. Betty had said that if that happens, she'd pay for more food, but we see prevaricating Betty again. The approval will actually come in the day after they sailed. To be fair to Betty, she's already stumped up more than she'd promised, and then Drake's logistics man fucked about with his sums for a few days, delaying the letter to Betty with the all-important amount required. Point is, the guys have sailed with inadequate provisions. There's no way they can now attempt all three tasks. Some of the investors were with the fleet, so they want the best financial return. They're going to push for Lisbon, because these suckers believe Dom Antonio will pay them back once he's there, and then they can get that nice profitable trade going. Almost unbelievably, we've also sailed without siege equipment. It's a bit hard to take a fortification without the gear to take a fortification. One final problem for Francis Drake. Robert Devereux. Robert thinks there's a big pile of cash just waiting for him somewhere out there. Betty will say, Robert, you're not going. Robert will wait till the last minute, then nick off, after having written 40 letters to different people. To Grandad, he wrote, what my state now is, I will tell you. My revenue no greater than when I sued my livery. My debts at the least 2,000 or 3,000. Her Majesty's goodness has been so great I could not ask more of her. No way left to repair myself but my own adventure. Off he goes to the Swiftsure, which had been held back by soldier mate. They will sail off on the Swiftsure, but keep well away from the main fleet. Betty had sent guys after him, but they were too late. She'll write to Drake and Norris, saying, send that bad boy home. But he's not with the fleet. Unlike Drake's previous voyage to Portugal, done in top secret, this one was no secret at all. Phil knows they're coming. Half of Dom Antonio's men were leaking to the Spanish. Phil had the entire details and plans of this venture. First stop will be Corunna, where Drake had done so much damage to the under-construction armada. Phil was not expecting us there because this time there's nothing really there. Off we go, doing a nice bit of killing while people are running off to the castle. English common smellies will be in plundering and getting on the booze and, sadly, wasting food that we really, really need. Still, the English can pick up some food from the countryside with the Spaniards hiding in their castle. Good, we've got food. Not good. Wind will keep us in the harbour for 2 weeks, and that's long enough for us to eat all that food we just got. Sir John will hear that a Spanish force is heading in, said to be 15,000 guys. Sir John will be off to look for them and find about 8,000. Still way more than the English. Problem is, they're across a river with just a small bridge about 80 foot long. But the English will start running across and into the Spanish. The Spanish had come running from the other end, and when they eat in the middle, Spaniards will be just bowled over. Spanish army will run away. Shitty terrain for running away, and the English are in a killing mood. Over a couple of thousand Spaniards won't be going home. And the Spanish will lose all that stuff to the English. Then it's set fire to the countryside, because, sadly, for our English having fun, it's time to move on. Sail away with me, honey. Put my heart in your hand. Sail away. Sail away with me. What will be, I wanna hold you now. Yeah, that was a nice little bit of David Gray, wasn't it? In comes the Swiss Shore with Robert Devereux. Drake will write to Betty, "Hey, you can have Robert back, but I can't spare the Swiss Shore to take him." We're back to sea, but where next? Not enough food to think about more than one target. Betty wants the Armada destroyed, and investors want Lisbon. They'll write home saying, "We need more everything. Ships, supplies, guns, munitions." Just like all the previous letters they'd sent home. Decision time, and if it's the merchants making the decision between national security and getting rich, they will always pick getting rich. Lisbon then is the target. Betty will be furious. Sorry, Betty, you should have made sure they had food and siege weapons. Off we go, heading towards Lisbon. In a headwind, so nice and slow, allowing disease to kill plenty of English. Lisbon is being held by Phil's nephew, Cardinal Archduke Albert of Austria. He doesn't have that many Spanish troops. He does have a large militia of Portuguese, but will these guys turn into Dom Antonio supporters? Lots of Portuguese, suspected of loyalty to Dom Antonio, will be tossed in the slammers, and the executions can start. Then we come to Peniche, just north of Lisbon, with our disease-ridden, hungry army, led by guys who may not have thought this through. Their only hope of success is if all the Portuguese all flock to Dom Antonio. Let's say that happens. Then what? Spanish Phil won't be saying, "Oh, Lisbon now belongs to England, and the English chances of holding it are really pretty much zero." They've been letting Dom Antonio flap his gums too much. Robert Devereux, always wanting to be the hero, will be first off the ship, followed by his younger brother. They'll get into the suburbs, and already the men are hungry. Locals have gone behind the walls, and the English are being told, "No plundering, we want to keep the Portuguese on side." On the plus side, the castle will surrender to Dom Antonio. Yeah, big deal, who wants that one? The English will look to their next plan. The officers called in the Earl of Essex and the commanders and took counsel on what seemed the most opportune thing to do. With a unanimous decision and vote, they decided that Norris should proceed with an army to Lisbon, which was at but 8,400 paces from Peniche, that Drake with his fleet, his arms, provisions and equipment should approach him and remain at Cascais, in order to see whether there were any sympathetic to King Antonio. They shook hands and Norris took charge of the army and Drake got the fleet. Can't go wrong, can it? Norris has about 6,000 guys, but not much in the way of supplies and no big guns. Cardinal Archduke has been spreading stuff about how awful the English heretics are. Drink the blood of babies and so on, to stiffen up the Portuguese resistance. English are again under no loot, plunder or rape orders to try and show that they are heroic liberators. Drake will land at Cascais and the town will run away. Drake will send guys after them saying, "Hey guys, all cool. Just say Dom Antonio's your king and we'll all be buddies." Back come the locals and again, no loot, plunder or rape for the English. Both Norris and Drake are proceeding with unusual caution. They know it all depends on the Portuguese rising against their Spanish masters. This caution stuff is not the Francis Drake we know, so perhaps he was a bit crook or getting old. He's about 50, so old age isn't likely to slow him down just yet. Whatever. He'll get the news that Norris is in Lisbon 2 days after the fact. Even so, he'll wait until the next day to call a council. The council will say we shouldn't go. Too dangerous and we've got too many sick guys. Here's our normal Francis Drake back now, saying, "Fuck it, we're going in." The English troops are tired, even sicker, probably from the water, but no Spanish attacking. English are in the suburbs waiting for the Portuguese to leap out and support them. Portuguese don't want to. Well, maybe half a dozen did, but that's about it. Cardinal Archduke is in the castle with the food. Spanish types will wander out for skirmishes, getting the English to use up valuable powder and shot. The English really need supplies. The English are dying in skirmishes and from sickness. Here come some Portuguese horse to help out. All his horse could not make a cornet of 40, nor his foot furnish 2 ensigns fully. Yeah, it's a big nothing burger again. Robert Devereux will wander up to the castle door and give it a good knock. Anybody home? Good for a laugh, but not much else. The trouble is, English are getting weaker while Spanish reinforcements are coming in the back door. Dom Antonio is saying, let's hang in there because my brave Portuguese will rise any tick of the clock. But we don't have many spare ticks of the clock. The English are, by now, outnumbered, so they're going to retreat toward Cascais. How come Spanish hard men on horses to kill stragglers and Robert Devereux will be bringing up the rear guard? About a third of those English forces will not be going home. The land attack has been a dud, and we need somebody to blame. Let's see, we have a handy non-Englishman, Dom Antonio, to take the blame. He'll say it's Betty's fault for not sending us immediately to Lisbon to do the surprise motherfucker. Others will say it was Drake's fault for sitting on his ass in Cascais for a couple of days. Others will say it's both Drake and Norris for not listening to us. They should have listened to us. Two so overweening spirits condemning to be advised and disdaining to ask advice. Yeah, well, Drake and Norris had pretty much followed instructions, and now at least we know that Dom Antonio is definitely a total dud. Cascais will surrender to Drake, with the garrison being told to piss off. Spaniards will come in, but as soon as Norris forms up, they'll just run away. Drake will be able to plunder 60 ships, which is nice. Those little duchy boats he'd nicked will be filled with corn and sent to England. English supply ships come in with a letter to Robert Devereux from Betty. Essex, your sudden and undutiful departure from our presence and your place of attendance, you may easily conceive how offensive it is, and ought to be, unto us. Our great favours bestowed upon you without deserts has drawn you thus to neglect and forget your duty. For other constructions we cannot make of these your strange actions. Not meaning, therefore, to tolerate this your disordered part, we gave directions to some of our Privy Council to let you know our express displeasure for your immediate repair hither, which you have not performed as your duty does bind you, increasing greatly thereby your former offence and undutiful behaviour in departing in such sort without privity, having so special office of attendance and charge near our person. We do therefore charge and command you forthwith, upon receipt of these, our letters, all excuses and delays set apart, to make your present and immediate repair unto us, to understand our further pleasure. Whereof see you not fail, as you will loath incur our indignation, and will answer for the contrary at your utmost peril. Oh, ah, Robert's been a naughty boy. But by the time he got back, Betty had forgotten about it. He got a very warm welcome, and about the same time, Raleigh will be off to Ireland. Gossip magazine saying Robert has become the new favourite, but Raleigh will reasonably point out that Betty gave him a ton of Desmond land, and he's got 144 English tenants needing supervision. Another letter will go in from Betty saying, why haven't you finished off that armada? But she still didn't send siege equipment with that letter. Should have sent siege equipment, not a letter, Betty. The fleet will say, well, we've achieved fuck all really, so we really should have a go at the Azores. Spaniards have had some time to organise their ships, so they'll come in and sink a couple of slower English boats. Bad weather, and that's not fun for sick people on a ship. They will end up at Bayona in northern Spain. Even though we're down to just 2,000 fighting men, the Spanish will run away and the town's taken. Drake is up for one last go at the Azores, so it'll just be the fittest ships to go with him. Straight into a storm. The rest of the fleet, like the Armada before it, will just limp home with tales of unhappiness. In comes the Dreadnought, which had managed to leave Spain with 300 survivors. 114 of those are dead, 168 ill, 18 fit for duty. In comes the Gregory with only 4 fit for duty. In comes the Griffin with 6 fit for duty. About 10,000 English have died on this venture. It's a monumental failure. Time for decisive action. Bring on the PR team to make this a mighty victory. You already know that we're into bullshit territory, but we can confirm this. Mighty hero Francis Drake, not known for his modesty, will not be involved in this PR stuff. Others will. Norris will write to Walsingham. If Spanish Phil had done this to England, there'd be bonfires all over Europe. Another of the leaders will put out the same message. Betty's official comment is that there hath been as much performed by you as true valour and good conduct could yield, and the men had as great valour as ever a nation did. Yes, it's all magnificent for her. Betty will have guys straight back to see Drake and Norris to say, what's next, lads? The council is split between going to finish the Armada or hitting treasure ships in the Atlantic. But Drake and Norris know their men and ships will need time to recover. Norris will write to his brother, we must be better used before I enter into any new service. He's talking about the failure of the government to adequately provide supplies. It's always the blame game, but really, with low food supplies, they should have just left a heap of men behind and gone with the numbers that were sustainable. On the other hand, telling them to finish off the Armada while saying no siege weapons was just plain stupid. Worse, of course, the council want to take charge of the plunder, while Norris points out that the contract says he and Drake will distribute the plunder. The government is concerned because some of those ships Drake had plundered were neutrals like Denmark and Germans. That's okay-ish, but we need to go through the legal process first. Plus, there's been the usual guy slipping stuff off the ships without declaring it. The captains will just hop in and start selling cargoes. Privy Council will send guys in to check what's going on and start ordering stuff be given back. Drake and Norris don't care. The law says they can do this, and bear in mind, the sailors are stuck on ships until the goods are offloaded and they've been paid. Sailors and soldiers this time won't be waiting. They'll be off those ships, marching to London, screaming for their wages. Arrests will be made with four guys hung. One will say, yeah, this is how you get rewarded for fighting for your country. Sick guys can't get medical attention because we're worried they're infectious. This ship will actually take a couple of years to sort out. At one stage, both Drake and Norris will be up on charges, but they'll both be acquitted. Back in Lisbon, supporters of Dom Antonio will be executed. Dom Antonio is off to live in poverty outside Plymouth, but he'll have his good days and say it was only the lack of siege guns that had prevented him from being King of Portugal. I might be with him there. Eventually he'll come to grips with his situation and resign the kingship. The end of it is, in short, that we have returned to this port of Plymouth, which is a just recompense for my sins. I recollect very often what you told me about an astrologer who said a great victory was in store for Philip, and I confess it has grievously troubled me ever since. I am in such a state of mind that I cannot talk, and hardly know what I'm saying, but this I can assure you, that 4,000 Englishmen are equal to 8,000 Spaniards, and whenever I can embark with them again, I shall gladly do so, especially if Sir John Norris and Sir Francis Drake be amongst them, for by my faith, they are gallant gentlemen. Yeah, wanker. We need to turn our attention to Francis Walsingham for perhaps the last time. If your Francis Walsingham is Geoffrey Rush to Kate Blanchett's Queen Betty, then you might be a bit off track. His relationship with Betty was more than a bit difficult. He was certainly the guy who told it like it is to Betty, which would annoy her. She was used to flattery and bullshit that Walsingham just didn't do. Francis would be more than a bit annoyed when Betty didn't take his advice or prevaricated. That might explain why he stitched up Mary. Walsingham saw her as a continual threat that needed removal. He was also the guy that got to give Betty bad news. He then often copped a verbal spray from Betty. Plus he had to put up with courtiers looking to put him down, because he's common. The salary was a piddling £100 and Betty gave him the odd decent income earner, but there was no generosity for Walsingham like her favourite spot. He was furious, for example, when Babington got done at Tyburn and Betty didn't give Walsingham Babington's stuff. Walsingham has been rather ill for quite a while, really. I haven't mentioned it before. He's had plenty of time off sick. But sometimes it seems he used his illness just to get away from Betty for a while. Now, it looks like he might have had both kidney disease and cancer. Slow, debilitating stuff. 12th of December, 1589, he'll draw up his will. It says he should be buried without any such extraordinary ceremonies as usually appertain to a man serving in my place, in respect of the greatness of my debts and the mean state I shall leave my wife and heiring. He's broke. 6th of April 1590, Walsingham will die. A Spanish spy will write to Phil, Secretary Walsingham has just expired, of which there is much sorrow. Spanish Phil will pay tribute to Walsingham's skills by noting on that paper, yes, but it is good news here. A little bit of Joe Bond Summer there to get us into some historical fiction. And this week I had a crack at a book, Wife to the Bastard by Hilda Lewis. It was published in the 1960s. The wife, of course, is little Matilda, and the bastard is our Bill. I do like to read novels about historical women because they don't feature so much in the history. So it's nice to see an author try to get into the mind of these women. This is not a cheery little tale. It's pretty dark. Well, I guess if you're married to Bill the Bastard, yeah, it would be pretty dark. So the characters are pretty well drawn out. We've got Matilda, who doesn't love Bill. She doesn't love him at all, but she's smart and she's ambitious for him. So, of course, she gets to be Queen of England, which she's quite pleased about at first, but then probably by the end, I think she might have rather had a life as a farm person or something like that. Just raise a nice little family happily in the woods of Normandy somewhere. The boys are in there, and she makes Bill Rufus a bit of a psychopathic kid. Yeah, not a nice kid at all. It was a good read. I really enjoyed this. Wife to the Bastard by Hilda Lewis. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And a track I'm always happy to hear come up on the playlist is Nora Jones, In the Dark. So that's what we're going out with. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
It's just you and I, not a sound, there's not one sound, just the beat of my poor heart, oh, and I, down in the dark, in the dark, I get such a thrill. When he presses his fingertips upon my lips, and he begs me, please keep still in the dark.